voz lo oí.
Looks like we're shy of one horse.
You brought too many.
Pardon me for playing one of my favorite clips from my all-time favorite Western, Once Upon a Time in the West. The people who were involved in putting that movie together did a documentary not long after it. They came to my house in Fallbrook, California. I told them I'd just seen the movie. It's one of the greatest movies I've ever seen as far as a Western movie. They said, "Oh, you're kidding." I said, "You wait and see. That movie is going to go down in history," which it really has. Yeah. Once Upon a Time in the West. If you've never seen it, watch it. Terrible Tommy here, and it is Moonsday, July 28th, closing in on the end of the month. If you don't have it done now, your big plan, you better get it done because you're running out of time. Yeah. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And we're at resist.com. That's where our big super-duper Harvard-style racial libraries and so forth are open to you. And you can reach me at tm_metzger@yahoo.com. And we have our national phone number on the web now, which is 559-670-1473. So I'm going to change that every couple of days with a short message for you. And so if you want to give me a short message, well, give it to me. You want to give me a longer message? That's okay. I might be able to use it on the radio show. And don't forget, tomorrow, Tuesday, Sling Blade's supposed to be in here. Yeah, if he's still in the land of living, you never know, boy. That guy gets around. Now, if you want to see a good serial, in other words, several parts to it, go to Netflix. Generation War. It's a film, a fictional film, but pretty close to facts, the way it looks to me, of the entire war on the Eastern Front and into Russia, all the way from the beginning till the ignominious end and retreat. Generation War. It's on Netflix. I think you're not going to enjoy it. I mean, you're going to find it's a good film, but it's such a sad film. It's terribly sad that all these hundreds of thousands, maybe a million German troops, white German troops, and good white Russians had to die needlessly. That war never needed to happen. Terrible. Have you ever heard of a college, a black college that was 90% white? I'm going to tell you about one. It seems like a common sense conclusion to assume that student bodies at a historically black college and university, HBCU, mainly consist of Negro students. However, there are some HBCUs where African Americans, Negro Americans, comprise a minority of the student population. Shockingly, Bluefield State College's student body is 90% white. Located in Bluefield, West Virginia, the school is part of the West Virginia public education system and was founded in 1895 as Bluefield Colored Institute. At that time, the school served as a black high school. Many of the students' parents migrated to West Virginia to work in the coal industry. In the 1920s, the school became known as the Bluefield Institute. The school became a launching pad in the creation of the region's black middle class at the expense of the white middle class. Bluefield became fully accredited in 1954 after the Supreme Court's Brown v. Board of Education decision. Bluefield's student population began to change because black students were able to choose from a wider range of options for their education. In other words, they could infiltrate other white university campuses, maybe even take them over. The mining industry in the area also began to evolve with the introduction of new technology, which caused many families to look for work elsewhere. This, coupled with the return of white veterans from the Korean War who were able to use the GI Bill to attend school, instigated a transformation of racial makeup of the school's students. The 1960s brought many changes. The student population at Bluefield was now nearly half white. In 1966, the state chose the school's first white president, Wendell G. Hardaway. Hardaway soon hired 23 new faculty members who were all white, and the school's dedicated facility faculty dropped to just 30% black by 1967. The next 2 years brought lots of turmoil with students staging protests against Hardaway's discriminatory treatment of black faculty and students. Tensions also rose with the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, leading to death threats against the administrators and a list of demands being delivered to President Hardaway. Students continued to protest against what they felt amounted to mental genocide. There you go. That's a new one, mental genocide. Don't let the Jews hear about that. And the educational extermination of the black student. Educational extermination. Well, I'll tell you, they come up with some cool ones. Things soon became even more tense when dorms on the campus were closed in response to a bombing at the school's gymnasium. The dorms remained closed, and this was the final step in the two-decade journey of Bluefield, going from an all-black college to a nearly all-white commuter college. So blacks pretty much did it to themselves, didn't they? To this day, there were several lawsuits filed by former administrators accusing the school of racial discrimination. This leads many to wonder if the school should still be classified as an HBCU. The intersection of Bluefield's past and the present is an interesting one. The school's alumni association is all black and has never had a white member. Homecoming events no longer reflect the makeup of the student body, as most who attend are black, even though the school has a majority of whites, has been majority white for decades. Well, there you go. See what all this race mixing laws and all that kind of stuff cause? I mean, it's unbelievable. But in this particular case, it worked out for white people. Well, I got a call this morning from an AP reporter up there in North Dakota. And he wants to know what I'm going to do with that lot. And I said, I haven't quite figured that out yet. That lot that I have in Leith. VNN's got a lot there too, and Jeff Shope of the NSM's got a lot there. So they were celebrating a couple of weeks ago about how they got Cobb out of there, but looks to me like they got three worse people to worry about. We're property owners. We could probably take over the town by just voting. Yeah, so anyhow, so he was wanting to know, because I teased him a little bit about I might build a monument up there to Robert Matthews, or I might put a house trailer in there for wayward whites or whatever. I may let my friends who are 18-wheeler drivers, if they're in the area, park their 18-wheelers on the lot. I'm not sure what I'm going to do, but one thing for sure, we're not going to get rid of it. It'll be a constant reminder of old Craig Cobb, the property owners there, the three white race separatists. Here's an interesting story out of Poland. A criminal neo-Nazi gang numbering 14 members has been taken into custody by police in the northeastern city of Białystok. The arrests come as officers from the Central Investigation Bureau and functionaries of the Białystok police stormed 31 apartments and homes across the northeastern Podlaski region on Thursday morning, according to unofficial information obtained by the Polish press agency. The group may be responsible for a number of arson attacks on apartments owned by non-whites in the city last year. The police found firearms, ammunition, methamphetamines, marijuana, and a few thousand anabolic steroid pills during the raids. Police also found items containing Nazi contents and symbols. Police spokesman Mariusz Sokolowski informed, adding two marijuana plantations had been seized. Oh boy. More from Poland. Police in the northeastern city of Białystok are investigating an incident involving an assault on a teacher who lectures on the Holocaust by a group of Polish neo-Nazis. The woman was not hurt, but was scared into hiding, according to agency reports. The Polish branch of the notorious neo-Nazi group, Blood and Honor, which has links yet to another fascist faction, Combat 18, was behind a knife threat against a woman who teaches Polish children about the Holocaust in the city of Białystok in the northeast. The group called the Holocaust lecturer an enemy of the white race and threatened to put a knife in her back. Her photograph, telephone number, and a list of threats were pasted on their website. Jacek Persky from Never Again, a foundation that has launched many anti-fascist campaigns in Poland, has been monitoring the Blood and Honor website. Persky says that the Blood and Honor have been pretty active pasting names and phone numbers of potential victims on their homepage. Well, I would think that tactic would be a little bit risky. I think there's other tactics that would work much better. Indian titles or Mongol titles on football is getting out of hand. Anyone who thinks the cultural left is going to stop its political correctness with the Washington Redskins isn't reading USA Today. On the top of their sports front page on July 22nd, the paper reported on activists taking a stand against Redface, championing a group called Eradicating Offensive Mongol Mascotry. The group's creator, Jacqueline Keeley. Wait a minute. What's that stuff there? Now I got to find my place again here. These pop-ups will all of a sudden appear. Jacqueline Keeler now equates red face with blackface and wants all headdresses and other cultural insensitive costumes and makeup banned, followed by the banning of all Indian team names since they allow fans to play Indian with war paint and headdresses on. And so on. USA Today reporter Eric Brady reported how the San Francisco Giants have instituted a policy against fans wearing culturally insensitive attire. Apparently, a first-of-a-kind rule in the major American sports. How will the Giants brass judge what is intolerable, insensitive, and what is not? Well, Tommy says, I think this is good. We should ban all non-white symbols and so forth, whether it be redskins or whatever. Ban it from sports. Only have white names. Only have white names. That makes sense to me. Well, I see Ocala, Florida has come out against nigger pants. Yeah. A Florida town has banned people, let's face it, young people, from wearing saggy nigger pants. A councilwoman for Ocala, Florida pushed for the passage of the law, but the town's mayor, Kent Gunn, may ultimately veto the fashion police. If the law does go into effect, it's unclear what measuring tools Ocala Police Department would use to determine whether a citizen's pants are within 2-inch legal limit of a theoretical waistline. It's even more unclear how they will determine where that waistline actually lies on the individual. Well, they just want to pick on niggers with slouchy pants, you know, the kind. They look like hell, don't they? Well, I doubt whether that law is going to go very far, but it sure would be nice if it did. Of course, maybe they should just have them take the pants off and go around town naked. That would be a sight to behold. Well, following the publication of a blatant hit piece by the Rolling Stones on Gun Owners of America, GOA Executive Director Larry Pratt on July 14th, Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney, Democrat, New York, I think she's probably black, but I'm not sure, representing New York City's boroughs of Manhattan, Queens, and Brooklyn, felt personally threatened and called the cops. Maloney's staff called the Capitol Police and the House Sergeant of Arms, Paul Irving, to say that Pratt's comments published in the Rolling Stone could be taken as a personal threat to her safety, and they should investigate. Quote, the extent to which Mr. Pratt's organization is involved in making threats against other elected officials, unquote, as well, she added. These comments are especially reprehensible in the light of what happened to my good friend Congressman Gabby Giffords, who suffered a traumatic brain injury as a result of a gunshot wound received during a public event. Pratt's rhetoric essentially invites similar attacks on other members of Congress. Oh. The cops called back to tell her staff that there was no specific danger and there's nothing to be done, unquote. What set Maloney's teeth on edge was what Rolling Stones reporter Alexander Zetchiff wrote that Pratt had said in a recent Leadership Institute presentation concerning the real meaning and purpose of the Second Amendment. Zetchiff was operating without the assistance of Pratt, who declined to be interviewed for the piece, forcing Zetchiff to rely on public records. He took journalistic license in characterizing Pratt as a fear-mongering and paranoia-stoking zealot in a long meandering trip through what he called the gun movement's aqueduct into the dark cross-currents of militia movement and radical right. You know, I was wondering after watching that movie last night why they call militia. Why don't they call partisans? That's a softer term. Yeah, instead of militias, let's call them partisans. Zelichek said his article was written in Pratt's voice because he has personally overseen engineering and construction of this aqueduct while building a larger gun movement, man. Here is Zatchek's summary of what Pratt said about the Second Amendment that so enraged Maloney. The Second Amendment is not for hunting. It's not even for self-defense, Pratt explained in his leadership talk. I've been trying to tell people that for years. I'm glad he came out and said it. Rather, it is for restraining tyrannical tendencies in government, especially those in liberal, tyrannical end of the spectrum. There's some restraint, and even if the voters of Brooklyn don't hold them back, it may be there are other ways that their impulses are somewhat restrained. That's the whole idea of the Second Amendment. Absolutely, Mr. Pratt. That's what I've said for years. It wasn't put in the Constitution to keep you from going hunting. It was to protect you from the assholes in the government. Maloney was certain that Pratt was referring specifically to her, not only because she is from Brooklyn, but also because she is a fervent supporter of anti-gun legislation, such as the Gun Trafficking Prevention Act of 2013, and she demands that gun owners be required to carry liability insurance, just as automobile owners do. Well, it seems odd to me that these progressives are always scared to death that the fascists have taken over. In fact, the fascists are already there, but they want to turn their guns in. They don't want to have any guns. That doesn't make sense. Her call prompted a response from Pratt, who wrote an open letter to Congresswoman Carolyn Maloney a week later, amplifying his remarks by quoting from the Declaration of Independence. Oh, jeez. And from Frederick Douglass, Justice Anton Scalia, in his majority opinion in the Supreme Court case, District of Columbia versus Heller, the former Supreme Court Justice Joseph Story. To illustrate Story's position, recall that he said in his comments on the Constitution, the right of the citizens to keep and bear arms has justly been considered as the palladium of liberties of a republic, since it offers a strong moral check against the usurpation and arbitrary powers of rulers, and will generally, even if these are successful in first instance, enable the people to resist, triumph, and kick their ass in the second instance. Pratt ended by hoping that Maloney would take the time to brush up on her reading and understanding of the Constitution that currently allows you to serve in the people's house and come to understand the great principles in which the nation was founded. She certainly could use a little brushing up on the Freedom Index, published by the New American, John Birch Society, to track congressmen's adherence to the Constitution. Since her first term began, Maloney has scored a discreditable 21 out of 100. Well, anyhow, nobody should argue about having a gun. No matter what happens, no matter how many laws are passed, you should find a way to have a gun. I don't care how deep in the ground you got to bury it, because your survival and your neighbor's survival may depend on, and probably will depend on, weapons. So you're not going to go pretty please to some politician. Can I keep my gun? I'm just going to go hunting rabbits with it. Congressman Maloney, you're full of baloney. Well, let's see what the NSers are doing in the Ukraine. Lation, Kapsua, Murmur, Ili, Itse. Wait a minute. I don't understand that. For starters, Andriy Poruby, the new secretary of the Ukraine Security Council, was the founder of the neo-Nazi Social National Party of the Ukraine, SNPU, otherwise known as SVOBODA, and his deputy, Mitro Yarosh, is the leader of a party called the Right Sector, which, according to historian Timothy Stanley, quote, flies the old flag of the Ukrainian National Socialist Collaborators at its rallies. The highest-ranking right-wing extremist is Deputy Prime Minister Oleksandr Syk, also a member of the Svoboda, who believes that women should lead the kind of lifestyle to avoid a risk of rape. including refraining from drinking alcohol and being in controversial company. Unquote. This is the philosophy underlying one of his legal initiatives, according to the Kyiv Post. Quote, to ban all abortions, even for pregnancies that occur during rape. The Svoboda Party has tapped into the Nazi symbolism, including the Wolf's Angel rune, which resembles a swastika and was worn by members of the Waffen-SS, a panzer division that was declared a criminal organization at Nuremberg. A report from Tel Aviv University describes the Svoboda Party as an extremist right-wing nationalist organization which emphasizes its identification with the ideology of German National Socialism. So there you go. That's the way that goes. They sound a little reactionary to me. I don't think my lady'd be too happy about that, not being able to have a mixed drink once in a while, for goodness sake. And what if some girl's raped by a nigger or Asian or something? He won't let her get an abortion? I think that's too much Christianity in that party. Well, they are recruiting usually dumb white guys to go over and be kamikazes for the Islamics. Here's one.
An Al-Qaeda-linked group fighting in Syria has released video of the first American to carry out a suicide attack in that country's civil war. The video shows U.S. citizen Munir Mohammed Abu Salah with other fighters before a May 25th attack that targeted several army positions. It's unknown how many people were killed in the bombing. The 22-year-old appears smiling in the video and speaks in broken Arabic, saying, I want to rest in the afterlife in heaven. The video was released by Nusra Front's media arm and posted on jihadi websites. Abu Salah grew up in Florida and attended several colleges before dropping out and moving abroad. Thousands of foreign fighters have gone to Syria to fight against President Bashar Assad's forces after the uprising against his government began 3 years ago. A State Department official says the U.S. does not track the activities of U.S. citizens abroad, but is concerned about the flow of foreign fighters into and out of Syria and its implications for broader stability in the region. Hannah Buchdahl, Associated Press. To understand what's happening in Iraq...
Don't forget, over 2,000... Americans have volunteered for IDF service in the Israeli Defense Forces. Oh, yeah, everybody's going everywhere. Here's a clip here explaining the differences between the Shia and the Sunni, and I'm sure a lot of you don't know.
To understand what's happening in Iraq right now, you really need to go back to 632 AD. That's when the two main Muslim groups, the Sunnis and Shia, had a pretty big falling out after the Prophet Muhammad died. Shias believed only a blood relative could succeed him, but Sunnis thought their spiritual leader could be any devout follower of Muhammad. The modern struggle is about religion, politics, and boundaries. The vast majority of the world's 1.6 billion Muslims are Sunni. In countries like Egypt, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Syria, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Shia Muslims are actually a tiny minority overall. In Iran and Iraq, Shias are in charge. But in Iraq, that wasn't always the case. There was Sunni rule under Saddam Hussein because he was on that team. When the U.S. invaded Iraq and toppled Saddam in 2003, who could forget this image, right? Sunnis were out of power, kicked out of the police force, and pretty much brushed aside by the new Shia government. The minority Sunnis were not happy. Some of them even joined forces with Al-Qaeda as it began to infiltrate Iraq and wreak havoc all over the place. This was the insurgency U.S. forces tried to keep at bay for 8 years. But this Al-Qaeda-Sunni mashup became too violent and extreme for the country's more moderate Sunnis. So they got friendly with U.S. troops to fight them. That became known as the Anbar Awakening. Across the border in Syria, ISIL, which they're now called because they want to establish a caliphate or Islamic state that extends far beyond Iraq and Syria, regrouped, trained, and amassed some serious arms and equipment. This group has been linked to massacres, executions, beheadings, and kidnappings, even of women and children. Their tactics so brutal, Al-Qaeda's core leadership didn't want anything to do with them. Since the U.S. withdrew military forces from Iraq in 2011, Iraq's Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has made life even more difficult for Sunnis in his country. That's why they don't seem too upset about ISIL's increasing power, and in some cases, are even joining them. ISIL wants to create a Sunni Muslim state governed by Sharia law. Right now, their goal is regional, but experts believe they may soon begin exporting terrorism around the globe. Thousands of foreign fighters, including some Americans, are fighting alongside them. The group has taken over more than 20 cities so far, added $430 million to their war chest after robbing a bank in Mosul, and they've even attacked the country's largest oil refinery. And those Iraqi security forces the U.S. spent $20 billion training, well, many of them have refused to fight. Oh, and did I mention there's one more group you should know about? The Kurds are a fairly steady ethnic faction in northern Iraq, which is saying something considering the instability in the country right now. The Kurds want their own independent state, but the U.S. is urging them to stick with Iraq. Basically, it's a mess and a big problem for the U.S. and the entire region. How it will all play out remains to be seen, but because you know at least some of the players and dynamics, you'll be able to say, now I get it.
Boy, oh boy, there's no joy in Mudville. Big flap in the black community. Community? I don't think so. But anyhow, this guy, Stephen A. Wise, who's a professional sports announcer, sparked a firestorm of controversy around statements he made on ESPN's First Take. And I've been hearing people comment on him all last night on satellite radio. Quote, "What I've tried to implore the female members of my family, some of who you all met and talked to, and what have you, it is that again, and this what I've done this all my life, let's make sure we don't do anything to provoke wrong actions," unquote. The core premise of his otherwise meandering statement was crystal clear. Victims need to make sure they do their part not to provoke an attack between men and women. The response to his statement on social media was swift and furious. For hours, he was barraged by men and women of all races on the fallacy of his position. And when he followed up later on Twitter, he mansplained how his words were taken out of context while essentially doubling down on the one that got him in trouble in the first place. Quote, "But what about addressing women on how they can help prevent the obvious wrong being done to them," unquote. Smith stepped into a pile of crap when it comes to women isn't new. In the past, he's tweeted support for known perpetrators of abuse such as Floyd Nigger Merriweather, and when former football player Nigger Chad Johnson was arrested for headbutting his wife Evelyn Lozada, he diverted the attention from Johnson's attack to his victim by saying, quote, "There's plenty of instances where provocation comes into consideration. Instigation comes into consideration. And I'll be on the record right here on national television and say that I'm sick and tired of men constantly being vilified and accused of things, and we stop there. I'm saying, can we go a step further since we want to dig deeper into Chad Johnson," and so forth and so on. In other words, they've got him standing up for these big black guys that beat up their wives. And the media is going crazy about this story. Literally crazy. Well, social media is so full of racism, it's unbelievable. A Canadian researcher launched the Twitter Racism Project of 2013. And now his findings are exposing just how prevalent racism still is on social media and possible reasons why its presence is so strong in the cyber realm. Irfan Chaudhry, a PhD candidate at the University of Alberta, and a part-time instructor at McKeewan University spent 3 months tracking and collecting tweets that used hurtful, racially charged language. The project focused on six major Canadian cities: Edmonton, Vancouver, Toronto, Montreal, Calgary, and Winnipeg. At the end of his research, Chaudhry had noted that more than 750 cases were where users utilized racist language. He also noted that in all these cases, the language was being used with the intent to harm, as opposed to being a racially insensitive or poorly thought out joke. Wow. In fact, the racist remarks were made as real-time responses to what people were witnessing in their personal lives. One example that struck out was, I'm sitting on a bus between two packies, for example. And I found that surprising, because the real-time they're writing while it's happening to them, and to have that be almost half the tweets I collected was very striking. Paki is a shortened version of Pakistanian and has often been used as a racial slur that dates back to the 50s when Asian immigrants were arriving in the United Kingdom, the disunited kingdom, for the first time only to be met by racially charged insults. You dirty Paki! Get off my bus! While not all the immigrants, invaders, were from Pakistan, the term was easy to remember and often used in a derogatory manner to refer to any of the newly arriving invaders. Chaudhry added that he hopes this helps people realize that while racism may not be as prevalent as it was in the past, it's still a very real part of our everyday lives. Wow. Quote, racism still does exist, maybe not, thankfully, as overt as before, but we still can't discount that it does exist, and when you see some of the tweets, it's very direct in its focus, he said. He also added that he hopes his research will help people realize just how powerful social media is, especially Twitter. He added that Twitter could also be used to track sexist language and homophobic language as well, and help us get a better idea of how prevalent these social issues are. So that was the end of that, man. He been researching it. Oh boy, China's in big trouble. Yep, China's in big trouble. Hundreds of police took down a church's cross in eastern China early Monday amid a crackdown on church buildings in a coastal region where thousands of people are embracing Christianity. You're insane. Do not, please. Catholic church weddings have declined 40% between 2000 and 2012. You're finally wising up. Well, boys and girls, I'm running out of steam, and this is a bad news day. I'm going to take us back to 1993 to a radio show we did back then and see what the hell was going on. And that's about 11 years ago. How about that? Any dates or telephone numbers you hear on here, forget, because they're not active anymore. Goes for addresses, too.
Calling. White Area Resistance calling. White Area Resistance calling. This is Tom Metzger joining you for another in our series of Torchlight Talks. It is March 28, 1993, for all our listeners. Another in our series of Torchlight Talks. First, the nation's number one white supremacist will give his blessings to our message. I never thought we could get him to do it, but he has agreed. He is none other than Morris Seligman Dees, owner and operator of the Southern Millionaires Law Center and leading sin eater for guilt-ridden American white liberals who are for the most part rich exploiters of non-white labor. Also, the poor Social Security recipients who give very generously to any cause that makes them real warm and gushy down inside. Morris, get on in here. Come on. You said it before. You said it last week. Now say it again, all right? Do it again. I want to hear it.
I hate people. And say what you want to in that respect. This country, the First Amendment guarantees the right to hate people. And say what you want to in that respect. In this country, the First Amendment guarantees the right to hate people. And say what you want to in that respect.
Well, that's great, Morris. Thanks a lot for giving us permission to do that. But wait a minute, Danny Walsh just came through the door. What's your problem, Danny?
I said no! I said no! I said no! The answer is no!
Well, he already did it, so that's all you can do about it. Forget it. Get on out of here, Danny Welch. Don't miss the April issue of War featuring Morris Dees and his white supremacist connection. Send your subscription of $30 per year to John Metzger, P.O. 1892. Anti-Defecation League Audit of Anti-Semantic Incidents is on the market. This 50 pages of hot stuff is available for a $10 donation, or call your local Chosen Pipples ADL office and ask for a free copy. Make sure you say how much you hate the neo-Nazis, and they will shower you with goodies, kits, all kinds of literature. The ADL has also made a videotape to distribute to all Iron Heel agencies. Of course, they've been showing it for some time. The Semites want to make sure police academies receive proper programming before being sent to the streets. A warning to all police and police departments, you better look into this very closely and decide which side of the fence you're going to be on as time goes on. Around 30 state legislatures adopted Semite-style hate law legislation in the last few years. This gives you a little idea of the cowardice, not the strength of the Jews, but the cowardice and nigrophilia that has captured the minds of sheepish whites in power. These people don't deserve to have power. Let's take it away from them. Never forget that the major funding for ADL operations comes from Semitic cells in almost every town or city around the country, throughout North America and the world. These spy cells are called B'nai B'rith Lodges. Yeah, they meet in little bank rooms and public auditoriums all over the place. They act as money-raising apparatus and intelligence centers that feed regional offices and national offices in New York City. Many, many, many judges, lawyers, police chiefs, and so forth belong and support the ADL. War has tracked most of the large contributors, especially in the West, and is always aware of their locations. There are a few double agents now floating around the movement. Don't worry, War is aware of most of this ADL operation. These agents work primarily within the Eastern and Southeastern right-wing Klan groups. However, they're not totally in that area. The American Jewish Congress and the Canadian Jewish Congress and the Simon Wiesenthal Center and all these boys also have their apparatus in place, all fighting over the same buck with Morris Dees. Most Semite groups are jealous of each other and routinely compete for funds and routinely squabble behind the scenes. In short, the two Semites have their lists, and so do we. And remember, they're not near as powerful as people think. It's just white leadership has become so weak. The only question now is which will ultimately achieve total power in this country, in North America. It's up to the will of the Aryan nation. Dateline, Canada, Saturday, March 27th. Major activity took place in Vancouver, B.C., and Toronto, Ontario. Order trigger Thomas Martinez was a well-paid speaker. Martinez has been financed fairly well over the last few years. He's getting fatter. Martinez refused witness protection, not because he was a brave man, but because there is more money to be made by appearing at Ford Brothers-style meetings, bragging about the shooting in the back of Jesse James, or in this case, Robert J. Matthews. The difference being, Martinez was even more cowardly than the Ford brothers. At least they had the guts to shoot Jesse James themselves. Martinez did not have that much fortitude. Martinez took counterfeit money for personal gain, buying items such as booze and lottery tickets and so on. How he ever got involved is beyond my scope, although I do know he belonged to two large right-wing racial groups for several years before he was able to penetrate the order. Over 100 white separatists marched and demonstrated in front of the Martinez meeting, chanting, "We want Tommy! We want Tommy! And we've got your number, Tommy!" and so on. The highlight was when Ernst Zundel, leader of world-renowned German initiative group in Canada and the Sonstadt Publishing Organization, he's a great semi-fighter, along with Wolfgang Droge of the Heritage Front, entered the meeting. As they entered, activists outside cheered and chanted, embarrassing the Yidlitz inside. When the anti-Aryan street scum saw the numbers of our comrades, they ran for cover too. Not to be outdone, Tony McLear of the Canadian Liberty Net held a successful gathering in Vancouver. Tom Metzger addressed that gathering by telephone. War announced a new war voicemail in Vancouver, which will be online in the next few days. The number is, and I can't give it to you right yet, boys and girls, War Dares, the Mud Relations Tribunals of Canada, to move against war and Tom Metzger. U.S. activists, get with it. Canada is passing you up. See how oppression builds resistance? Dateline, Detroit. Last update, Tom Metzger chided SS Action for a negative demonstration that took place. They were not totally responsible, and we don't like the take any pleasure in chiding well-meaning comrades. However, street action is a science, and if you choose to participate, it must be studied intensely. There is no excuse, because volumes have been written on the subject. Two of the most effective arrangements is the old British square or the diamond-shaped formation, also a V-shaped method used by Iron Heel police is very effective. These type of street formations go back to Rome and Persia and beyond. Tom Metzger is not speaking to you as some desktop publisher or armchair general so prevalent in the right-wing conservative arena. Tom Metzger is the veteran of numerous street actions and major riots. We have the videos to prove it. No comrade ever was seriously hurt or jailed or charged with a crime that followed Tom Metzger into the streets. That was no accident. Remember, one must be physically in shape. That means working out intensely at least three times a week. Most white activists are in horrible physical shape, unbecoming of an Aryan. 2, hours and hours of planning and strategy must be employed. Videotapes of the area must be reviewed. Communications must be in place. You must control the pay telephones in the area. In some cases, aerial photography. Yes, Tom Metzger has used aerial photographs in past situations. Training to ferret out informants and agent provocateurs. Most of these types now easily penetrate right-wing groups. They're not that hard to find if you use proper techniques. And the ways to use these techniques are written in many areas, and you can get them. People is obviously stupid, and a drug burnout like Ken Peterson from Janesville, Wisconsin, is a perfect example of what not to have around. How could any reasonably intelligent activist fall into these fiascos led by, number one, idiots, and number two, paid informants? Another thing, never show all your strength up front. Always keep the largest numbers of your people in close reserve. Reserve should never wear or look like your people, never uniforms or flags. If you want a good example of how this all works, simply rent the film Fist, F-I-S-T, that's Fist, with Sylvester Stallone, and you'll get a good lesson. send your questions on audio tape, and War will provide you with answers. Remember, street action is an extremely dangerous occupation, and it may backfire like it usually does for many Klan and Nazi groups and other right-wingers. If you'll see what has happened in Denver, Colorado a few times, and in other places where being surrounded and protected by police while hundreds of street scum wimps are trying to get to you is the worst publicity you can get. If you ever want to help the enemy, that is the way to do it. Another good book is The Red Dragon and the Black Shirts. It's available from us, showing how dedicated, strong political fanatics, even though outnumbered by 10 and 20 to 1, can take to the streets and win when they are attacked, especially if the Iron Heel cops will stay home, stay at the donut shop, and stay out of our business. In the meantime, spend 90% of your time planning and educating, 10% of your time in street action, if you must. Secrecy is even better. It's what they don't know that drives them crazy. Update, Washington, D.C. Interracial couples doubled in the past 10 years. One out of 50 marriages is between different races. There were 246,000 black-white marriages last year, four times the number since 1970. 883,000 couples were between whites and other than black races. This is only a count of actual marriages. Cohabitation between unmarried would probably be much, much higher. The Census Bureau says we have 1,161,000 interracial couples married, that is. Of course, we could care less how many Chinese marry Mexicans or Semites marry Negroes or Pan-Pacificans marry so-called American Indians. All we know is that the media, Hollywood, and the Judeo-Christian churches is where this insanity begins. Another reason to tax the churches and the synagogues. Support the taxation of the churches and synagogues. And your schools, too. That's where these little creepy teachers burrow in to put out this type of information of race mixing. It's that friendly little old lady or friendly young lady down the block that you accept as your friendly teacher of your children that is worse than any agent of Israel. Dateline technology, a new idea that is moving fast in TV news gathering, is the use of high-8 cameras. A revolution in news reporting is moving ahead using high-8 equipment. Let's get in on the ground floor. War needs your news footage from your area on topics of interest to war. And get out there and do something. Get that footage in here. Also, all associates should have a VCR in good working order. Every associate should have a VCR loaded and ready to go. Forget about the guns for a while. Loaded and ready to catch important information. Become an area news reporter in your area. And go to your enemy's meetings and quietly videotape them. Remember, information is power. TV cameras are more important at this time than guns. Don't worry about it. There's millions of guns and plenty of time to get them. Dateline, Falling Down. The movie. This film, like Birth of a Nation, is causing major upheaval in the fish wrap press community. Several white men fell down around the country last week alone. One Washington State, and one in Sacramento, California, and there were probably quite a few others. Indeed, falling down may soon become a major habit. War thanks you for your support. Purchases of video and audio tapes, along with books and donations, keep the projects moving. Become a friend of War by financially supporting on a regular basis. In closing, War does have a symbol. It is the skull and crossbones of the privateer. War sails under no national flag that exists today. The Jolly Rogers is sold almost anywhere. And if you want to say no to the state, no to the Iron Heel, the cops, the Semites, and all the rest of them, I see no better flag than the flag of the pirate privateer. Privateers made their own fortune and defended their own people and their own thing. They took no orders from other than people of the strongest among them. Sinn Féin. You may now leave a short message, and if you have questions, send an audio tape with your questions with a self-addressed and stamped envelope.
Well, that was back when we were doing, or I was doing half-hour shows. Yeah, it takes you back a little bit, what I'm saying. Everybody needs a VCR, and hey, we got a high eights coming in. I got a high eight sitting there over here on the shelf that I haven't used in a long time. So that was 11. Wait a minute. Yeah, 11 years ago. Yeah. Well, that's about it for today. I'll be back tomorrow on Tuesday. And well, by now you must be a little bit confused. Half the show was from 11 years ago, and half of it was from yesterday, that I thought I'd lost this part of the show that I did yesterday. And so we were going to do Sling Blade today, but we're going to postpone Sling Blade from today. And I ran this, so if I've got the date on there, this is the 20... Wait a minute, I can't even see my clock. July 29th, 2014. So we finally got it together. I don't know what happened. The show disappeared, and I finally came down here this morning, fired up the computer, and there it was. We got ghosts around here. 14-5, and we'll see you tomorrow on Wotan's Day. And don't forget to, if you've got Netflix, get that Generation War. Boy, I'll tell you, that's something else. Not Hollywood. This is made by the Germans.
My bills are all due, and the baby needs shoes, and I'm busted. Cotton is down to a quarter of a pound, I'm busted. I got a cow that went dry, and a hen that won't lay. A big stack of bills that get bigger each day. The county's gonna haul my belongings away, 'cause I'm busted. I went to my brother to ask for a loan. I was busted. I hate to beg like a dog for a bone, but I'm busted. My brother said there ain't a thing I can do. My wife and my kids are all down with the flu. I was just thinking about calling on you. I'm busted.
Eli?
Morning, George.
This is a white man's saloon, and it sells white man's liquor. And I'm telling you to crawl your filth out of here, Breed. Before I kill you. You hear, you red-skinned nigger? A white man's talking to you. You need stepping on, Breed.